It's only Dr. Sean Das returning. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad. Thank you, Mr. Knight. How are you doing? It's been a while.
Wonderful. Thank you. It's nice to see you. It's been, I think it's the third or fourth time maybe we've spoke now.
Yeah, yeah. Last time was quite a few months ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. So we should do this when you don't write, you don't call.
I'm ghosting you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so obviously, dedicated viewers of the show will be well familiar with your work and your output and your eloquent understanding of all things psychology. Maybe you could just let people know what it is you do for the people who are not familiar with your work.
Sure. Yeah. So I am a forensic psychiatrist. So I also work as an expert witness, which means I assess and rehabilitate people who have severe mental illnesses, who've committed quite serious crimes. So when this whole case, Kalakani, the Nottingham stabbing, occurred, this is very much, very much down my street. I've given evidence in these kinds of cases and I've got so much to say about it. So I just thought I had to reach out to you guys and to Sean.
This is great. Yeah, I'm so glad that you're here to talk about this because, I mean, we've spoke about this before. And there's obviously a lot of stigma around about mental health, a kind of big misunderstanding about schizophrenia in general. Now, a lot of people will be looking at this case now and seeing the words mental illness or, the fact that he had serious issues and saying, well, obviously, this is where it leads. It's violence. This is where mental health issues always leaves, certainly schizophrenia. What can you say about that? Because obviously there is an undeniable link between mental health issues and violence, but it's not the whole story, is it?
Yeah. So what I would say, Stephen, is that the vast, vast majority of people with schizophrenia are not dangerous. In fact, they're more likely to hurt themselves. So about 10% of people with schizophrenia end up killing themselves or to be the victims of crime. But if, in cases exactly like this, like Kalakane's, if they happen to have symptoms that are directly linked to potential violence, so to be specific, he was hearing voices, command hallucinations, telling him to kill people, and he was reportedly suffering from these paranoid delusions where he believed that he had to hurt people, otherwise something bad would happen to him and his family. So if they've got those very specific symptoms, which is rare, then they can be extremely dangerous. And I suppose my view as a forensic psychiatrist as opposed to a general psychiatrist is maybe a little bit skewed because that's exactly the kind of cases that I'm asked to assess.
So, I mean, at what point does something like that tip over into violence? Are there any, I suppose what people are really asking, aren't they, there's always a sort of 2020 hindsight bias aspect to these cases where people say, how was he able to do that? We should have been stopped at point A, B and C beforehand. Yeah. And I'm just wondering, does that argument play well for you looking at the facts of the case? Do you think there were some legitimate failings in that sense?
Yeah, I'm happy to answer that. I don't think my answer is going to be very popular because I think you kind of indicated this yourself. People want there to people would like, it is more comfortable to think that this was very predictable and it shouldn't have happened and services should have stepped in and it was preventable, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. My honest answer is, from my clinical experience, obviously, nobody's denying what he did was absolutely horrific, but I don't think there were that many red warning flags, right? I do think there were gaps in his care. So the very fact that Kalakane was admitted to hospital on several occasions, three or four times, I think, and then discharged within a relatively short period of time, and then was readmitted and kept becoming unwell again, to me suggests that there was a gap in the system. You know, he should have been followed up, possibly should have been detained for a longer period of time. I don't know because I've not seen the medical reports, but I suspect that maybe he wasn't fully well when he was leaving hospital. It's either that or he was fully well, but he was stopped taking his medication, in which case you could argue that there should have been more work to help him develop his insight so he'd actually take his medication. So I believe all of these things are true, but, and this is the controversial bit, his level of violence before the horrific stabbings wasn't actually that high. There was an assault against a police officer, and there's another sort of side argument that the police should have and could have arrested him because, as you may know, there was a warrant out for his arrest for about 9 months before the Nottingham stabbings. But that level of violence, police assault on a police officer, is actually not that uncommon. So I'll put it in a specific perspective. I work in a court diversion scheme, right? So I work in a criminal court in London, and that presentation of somebody who's recently assaulted a police officer is not unusual. If I saw that coming across my case, I wouldn't think, oh my God, this guy is completely dangerous. He's going to go out and kill multiple people. I would think he's one of 10 people that I've seen this week that are roughly the same risk profile as him. So that's a scary thing to say, but that is the truth from my clinical experience.
That's really interesting. And this is my fault. I think I've got ahead of the story here without kind of laying out the specifics. So maybe as best you can, just explain what this individual did. Why is this big news in our country at the moment?
Sure. So the man is called Kalakane, and he definitely had a history of mental illness. So as I mentioned before, he has a diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia. Just very briefly, schizophrenia isn't, as some people assume, anything to do with split personalities. Schizophrenia is a tendency towards periods of psychosis. A period of psychosis is when you step out of reality, usually in the form of hallucinations, so hearing voices, or delusions like paranoid thoughts. Kalakane had definitely had both of those things. And he was admitted a few times to hospital in the previous years, discharged fairly quickly. There was lots of clearly psychotic behavior. So the reason I'm saying this is because if any of your viewers are thinking that, you know, this is something that he made up or tried to push his own agenda, was trying to cheat the system, basically, I don't think that's the case, because there was lots of very bizarre behavior. About a year before the attacks, he went to MI5 demanding that they stop controlling him. He tried to hand himself in. There was really paranoid behavior about traveling for miles, sitting outside his family home and refusing to come in and thinking that people were going to die. So the point I'm trying to make is he was, in my mind, very psychotic for a very long period of time. And then he tragically went on this rampage on the 13th of June, I believe, 2023, and he stabbed and killed three completely innocent people and then got a van and tried to run over, I think it's another three people. So murder, attempted murder. The reason, Stephen, it's well, apart from the horrific nature of what happened, the reason it's so controversial is because many people think that he got an easy option because he got a finding of diminished responsibility. So not murder, but manslaughter because of his schizophrenia. And he got a hospital order. So he's going to spend many years, possibly the rest of his life, in a high secure hospital rather than go to prison. Family are really upset about it. And I think a lot of the members of the public are also upset about it.
Yeah. And obviously you would expect the family to be upset about it. They've lost people very near and dear to them, and they would want the maximum possible punishment and sentence. I think that would come closer to justice in their mind. So, I mean, but we kind of have to, in the kind of like a, you know, a very clinical way, put that to the side for a moment, and because it's a very emotive and not necessarily objective perspective. Do you think this decision was a fair one, given all the particulars?
Yeah, I absolutely think it was. I completely sympathize with the family. I can understand, you know, they feel so victimized and wrong, and they are, that they probably want him to suffer like they've suffered and like the victim suffered. But purely clinically, so if you look at the medico-legal definitions, so completely take out emotion, take out any my own personal sense of justice, forget all of that. If you just look at the medico-legal criteria for diminished responsibility, I'll read out some of the criteria. So you have to have an abnormality of mental functioning. He clearly did. He had schizophrenia, which arose from a recognized medical condition. So that's important, because it has to be because of an mental illness. It can't be somebody who happened to have schizophrenia but attacked people randomly because of rage or because he was insulted or, you know, in an argument with a lover. It has to be due to a recognized medical condition. And it substantially impaired his ability, or the defendant's ability, to do one of three things: either understand the nature of their conduct. And he probably did understand what he was doing, because, you know, he bought a knife, he tried to evade the police. So that probably wasn't impaired. Form a rational judgment. I think he did struggle to form a rational judgment because he was hearing these voices and because he had these delusions compelling him to kill random people, and to exercise self-control. And again, I think he had a problem exercising self-control. So that's a long, convoluted way of saying that he did meet quite clearly, I think, the medico-legal criteria for diminished responsibility. I do these cases all the time. Sometimes there's grey areas. Sometimes there's a bit of evidence either way. Sometimes it's not very clear to me. And again, I keep repeating myself, to take out emotions just on the medico-legal criteria, he clearly fits diminished responsibility.
So, I mean, I'm just probably straying stupidly into a philosophical realm here a little bit, but I suppose it kind of ties into this idea of free will. So I suppose the diminished responsibility argument would kind of suggest that, you know, his mental illness was responsible, and he really didn't, you know, he can't be held as responsible as somebody who wasn't mentally ill, who'd committed a similar crime. Now, I suppose, where do you fall on this issue of free will? Because a lot of people who don't really recognize the existence of free will would say, well, there's not really much difference between somebody who's been deemed to have a mental illness and therefore diminished responsibility versus someone who just went to murder somebody because they pissed him off or they didn't like him. You know, it depends where you fall on this free will argument, I suppose.
Yeah. So the way I'd answer that question is, let's take the two extremes and then let's take what I think his case is. So let's have one person on one extreme who did know exactly what they're doing, who went out with the intention to kill somebody, who is just, you know, born a vile, evil person, who might not have any mental illness. Maybe they do have schizophrenia in the background, but maybe the schizophrenia is completely irrelevant. Everybody, myself included, thinks that that person should get a murder charge. There's no doubt there. Let's take the other extreme of the spectrum. So there is, I mentioned diminished responsibility, which is what he got, Kalakane. There's another psychiatric defense, which is not guilty by reason of insanity, right? So as the name suggests, that means that you're completely not guilty. So you're completely exonerated. That doesn't mean there's no consequences. You might still end up going to hospital, still possibly for the rest of your life. But in the eyes of the law, you are not guilty. Hence, not guilty by reason of insanity. The threshold for that is much, much higher. So that means the person either didn't know what they were doing at all, they didn't understand that they were physically stabbing somebody, or they didn't know it was wrong, legally wrong. Kalakane, I think, did know those things because he knew he's going to prison. He did try and evade the police. So those are the two ends of the spectrum. You've got somebody with a clear mental illness who has no free will at all, and you have somebody who has absolute free will and mental illness is either not there or is not relevant. But Kalakane is somewhere in the middle. So he's diminished responsibility. So again, as the name suggests, it means he is held responsible, but his responsibility is less. So he's not completely blameless. So he's not completely, it's not felt that he completely didn't understand his actions, but at the same time, his overall ability to understand his actions was diminished. And I think that because he had this mental illness, and because the reason I'm saying this relatively confidently, and again, taking out morality out of here, is that the number of psychiatrists from both sides got the same symptomatology from him. They elicited the fact that he had these delusions. So another way of saying that is that, from what I've read, if he didn't have that mental illness, then he wouldn't have been compelled to carry out those killings.
That's a good answer. And I suppose, does this whole thing, the interest in it, is it because we can, at the big interest or the larger interest in this one particular killer, is there a bigger interest in this because it kind of parallels what we've seen for years now in terms of jihadist attacks? You know, it's almost a textbook carbon copy of like a frenzied stabbing attack, a vehicle attack rolled into one. I think that the people had, people went mad on social media as it was originally being reported that it was a terrorist attack. And now we're being told that this man's mentally ill. Does this in a way play into a lot of conspiracy theories you usually find on the right about covering up terrorist attacks and filing them under the sort of moniker of mental illness? And if so, perhaps it might be worth just explaining how that's not really a thing people can just pin. There are obviously levels to meet, trained clinicians that have to make these determinations.
Yeah. So I think that it's fair to say that I think the sympathy for the perpetrator, Kalakane, or the understanding of this kind of situation where you use a psychiatric defense is very much dependent on how the public perceives the particular offence. So another way of saying that, Stephen, is that again, I'm not in any way trying to undermine or minimise the impact of what he did. It's horrific. Nobody is disagreeing with that. But I suppose the point I'm trying to make is I think there is some crimes and some killers, some perpetrators that are judged more by society than others. So another way of saying that is I wonder if the killer was not, this sort of black immigrant man, young man, but say like a vulnerable young woman, I wonder whether people would have the same kind of vitriol against the fact towards them as an individual, and the same kind of disappointment in the legal system for allowing a diminished responsibility. So I really genuinely do think that that's part of it. I know that sounds like quite a bold thing to say, but just to put that into context, I have been on Talk TV a few times. I was on like Vanessa Feltzer's show, and there's clips of what I've said, and I've said pretty much the same thing as I'm saying to you. And if you read the comments underneath, they're very, very intense. They're quite right wing. Some of them are quite racist. And there's basically,
oh really?
Yeah. And I think they're basically, and it's fine. I put myself out in the media. I'm a big boy. I can take it. But basically, there's a thought process that because I'm an ethnic minority, that I'm protecting somebody of an ethnic minority. So I think there's I don't think it's representative of all society, but I think there's an undercurrent of judging him particularly because of his ethnicity. To your point of terrorist attacks, it's a completely different kettle of fish. It might look the same to the untrained eye. And some people might think that all terrorists are mentally ill because they don't understand their motivations, their behaviors. But crucially, a terrorist knows what they're doing. They know what they're doing is wrong. Even in their own warped head, they might have their justifications. They're not compelled. They're in control of their actions. They're not compelled by mental illness, by voices, by paranoid delusions.
That's a great answer. And I suppose some people would just, I think I struggle to get people to understand this sometimes when I'm trying to explain that, you know, not all suicide bombers are mentally ill. Some of them are, they're actually running a very rational kind of calculation or kind of software in their brain for what they're doing, in the sense that they can tell you exactly why they're doing it and what they hope to happen. And it's logically consistent. So how do you best kind of separate mental illness from like really extreme behavior that most people would look at and go, that's, you know, not to be too insensitive, but mental, that's crazy, that's indicative of mental illness, whereas in reality it actually isn't?
Yeah, so it's complicated. You know, that's why you need expert witnesses. And as I said, I think this particular case, Kalakani, is relatively black and white, but there are definitely cases that I've worked on where the answer is not clear. And you've had opposing sides and, you know, I've had to give evidence in court, either for the defense and the prosecution. So my point being that even the experts sometimes find some cases hard to definitively decide whether somebody's mentally ill. But to answer your question, it depends how you define mental illness. If you define it as doing something that nobody else could do or would do, then almost anybody that commits any kind of horrific violence, whether it's, you know, domestic violence, sexual violence, offending against children, terrorism, any of those things, is mental illness by that definition, which is not helpful, because then what's the point of calling it mentally ill if you know, almost anybody fits that category. There's the psychiatrist definition. So my definition, which would be they have to have a recognized mental illness like a psychosis with recognized symptoms. And the symptoms are not just extreme beliefs. The symptoms are delusional beliefs. So believing that there's one true religion and non-believers should die is not psychosis, but believing that, and I'm given a specific example of a case that I've seen relatively recently, if a mother believes that her child has been possessed by like demons and has to end that child's life to save them from hell, for example, that is psychosis, you know. Or if somebody's hearing a voice and they, like Kalakane, if they're hearing a voice and they feel compelled to listen to that voice, because if they don't, then the world will end. That is, you know, that is mental illness. So it's all about the actual symptomatology, not just the beliefs. And then the final thing I'd say, Stephen, is that there's the layman's definition of mental illness is the psychiatrist, but probably the most important one is the legal aspect, the judge's criteria, which is what I said before: did they know what they were doing, and did they know what they were doing was wrong? So if a terrorist actively knew that they were putting on a suicide vest, and if they knew it was legally wrong, so not morally, but legally wrong, so they knew it's against the law to end somebody's life, then by definition, they have the insanity plea.
It's a very good answer as always, Shahom. And I just want to get background to this, you know, this Kalakani idea of paranoid schizophrenia being accepted as the reason for his crimes. And I suppose people will be wondering, how does that explain what he did? I mean, what did he attempt to give any sort of justification that made sense? Because I think when something horrific's happened like this, something so tragic and horrible, people want an airtight answer. They demand explanations, and rightly so. But obviously, we rarely get one that'll satisfy, that's sufficient. But how does paranoid schizophrenia explain this in any way?
Sure. So again, I just wanted to make the point that the vast majority of people that have paranoid schizophrenia and the symptoms they have don't lead to this level of violence. This is exceptionally rare. And I was obviously not assessed Kalakane in person, but I've read everything that's in the press about what happened in his court case. So the other psychiatrist, he gave evidence, and he consistently reported that he was hearing voices telling him that he needed to kill people or his family would be hurt. And as I said before, there was previous psychotic behavior. He tried to surrender to MI5, went to the MI5 headquarters trying to surrender. He believes that they were taking photos of him. He was saying things like, stop controlling me. This was like a year before the stabbing. So it's not like he did it, you know, a couple of days before, because he's trying to preemptively make an excuse. There's a long history of this. He also, on top of the voices, he told another psychiatrist that he felt this like psychotic pressure to kill people, otherwise something atrocious would happen to his family. So there was these particular symptoms, I think, directly led or influenced his violence.
Okay, and I think one of the details that was revealed and released to the public was that he was actually on medication for mental health. I'm not sure if they was antipsychotics. I'm not sure if you know what they are, but they were found at his residence and they'd not been taken. And I just wanted to get your opinion on what kind of medication could somebody be prescribed for paranoid schizophrenia, and how would it work, and how successful is it in kind of mitigating some of the most extreme symptoms?
Yeah. So good question. So from what I've read in the newspapers, it doesn't say what medication was on, but I'm almost 100% sure that there will be some sort of antipsychotic medication, because that's what you did for schizophrenia. And people not taking their medication, so non-compliance in our patient group is very common, and it's probably one of the biggest hurdles to treat individuals with schizophrenia. And the reason they don't take the medication, Stephen, is often they don't have insight. So they don't believe that they're mentally unwell. There are some people with schizophrenia or psychosis that do believe that, but from my experience, it's because they've gone through the system of being admitted to hospital again and again and again. And so it's not that they necessarily, they still believe the symptoms that they're experiencing are real, but they've learned over time that they can't be real. It's a bit like, you know, that film, Beautiful Mind?
Yes, Russell Crowe.
It's been a while since I've seen it, but I'm sure there's a scene towards the end where he realizes that what he sees must be delusions because the little girl doesn't get any older.
Yes, it's been a while
So obviously that's a dramatic version of it, but it's that when patients do get insights like that, it's not that their experiences are any less real to them, it's because they've figured it out over time that it can't be real, because everyone else, it's not real to anybody else. But anyway, I'm getting sidetracked. So that's one reason that they lack insights. They don't believe they've got an illness where they need to take medication, and probably more important than that is the side effects. So antipsychotics, unfortunately, are not nice medicines to take. They almost, well, not almost all of them give you side effects from like movement dyskinesias, so like movement disorders, shakiness, stiffness. You can put on a lot of weight, drowsiness, dribbling for some of them. They can give you like cardiac arrhythmias, so they increase the risk of your heart attacks. They're not nice medicines to take, and you have to take these, you know, potentially for the rest of your life, or if not for many years. So I completely get why some people don't take their medication. In Kalakani's case, when he wasn't taking it, that's again very common, you know, and there's all this chat about doing all this about the NHS Trust having these investigations and blah blah blah, and I'm all for it, but I can tell you now what they're going to find, because it's the same as we have in all our patients. It's not news to psychiatrists. There is a kind of a potential solution around it, which is a depo. So a depo antipsychotic medication is an injection, right? So instead of having to take a tablet once a day, which a patient can fake, spit out, just not take, they go to their nurse. So if they're in the community, they go to their nurse. It's usually either every 2 weeks or every week, depending on the type of depo, and they get an injection. So then you know the medication is in them for that entire month, and you know if they're not taking it because they're not turning up to clinic. But there is a human rights issue. I know a lot of people listening to this will say, well, you know, screw the human rights. If it's somebody as dangerous as Kalakane, then they it doesn't matter what side effects they're getting, they need this medication, which is, I can understand the perspective. But we also have to bear in mind that for every one Kalakane, there's probably another 100 patients out there who are not dangerous, and you know, who won't go on to do anything like this. And they would quite reasonably have issues about being sort of forced this medication against their will that damages them physically.
That's a great answer. And I suppose that there will be a lot of renewed conversations, obviously, about mental health services in the UK, a lot of finger pointing as well. And I just wanted to get an objective view from somebody who would have a good handle on this about the state of our, you know, mental health services in the UK. I mean, what are the biggest challenges that faces mental health care in the UK? I mean, is it a funding issue? Is it an expertise issue? Is it a resources issue? Where are the kind of bottlenecks, do you think?
So I think from my clinical experience that I would say there's two major issues that I come up across all the time, like every single week, or maybe not every week, but at least once a month. Number one is the number of psychiatric beds. So to actually get somebody like Kalakane into hospital, it's different now that he's done what he's done, and you know, now he's in a high secure unit and he's so high profile, I think he's already in hospital now. So I'm not talking about now. I mean, before, in the lead up to it, when you've got somebody that's a little bit risky, but their level of violence hasn't been huge, and they're kind of not complying with medication, they're getting ill, and they're going into hospital. So somebody exactly like him, it's really hard to find a psychiatric bed. So even as a consultant in court, when I see somebody like that, sometimes it takes me 2 or 3 days to find a psychiatric bed, and that individual has to keep going back to prison to be remanded until that happens. Almost all trusts are constantly full, and they have to discharge somebody to get a bed free. So that's number one biggest thing in my view that needs to change, and that is a funding issue, like everything. And number two is the number of staff in the community. So again, somebody like Kalakane will have been on a caseload of, there'll be like a nurse or a team of nurses that have to look after, I don't know, 50, 100 patients similar to him, and they won't have the time to see them all, to supervise them particularly thoroughly in the community. And what kind of, I was going to say amuse is the wrong word. What frustrates me and what I kind of roll my eyes at, I guess, is the fact that there's going to be this investigation into the Nottingham NHS Trust. I can promise you the same thing is happening and has happened for years in all NHS trusts across the country. It's not that Nottingham dealt with this in a particularly poor manner. It's just that the system is so overloaded that there's lots of people like Kalakane, not now after the killings, I mean before the killings, but that level of risk, low level assaults, not fully better. There's hundreds of people like that in every NHS trust across the country. So if the government, if this review says that, you know, it's only a problem in Nottingham, we're going to put some more money into Nottingham, then to me that's going to be bullshit. You have to invest in the entire system, I think.
So I suppose just to throw a grenade into the discussion right near the end, a lot of people will say, well, and there'll be the people who are obviously leaning on the fact that this chap is, I'm not fully aware of his background. I don't know if he was born here, but they'll say that, I mean, was he an immigrant? They'll say, obviously, these NHS trusts are already, you know, to bursting point in terms of capacity, immigration's not helping that, you know, and the people kind of focus on his ethnicity in that way and look to immigration and reducing that to kind of alleviate the burden on our NHS. Do you have any kind of opinion on that sort of thing, especially now it's going to be obviously brought to the forefront in the next couple of weeks when people are discussing this case?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure how to answer that, really. I mean, obviously, if there is an immigration problem and if there are people that are coming in illegally and are not being monitored, then nobody's supporting that. I'm not supporting that. But also, if there are people who have immigrated, who have mental health issues, then we need to deal with them. Not only ethically do we have the resources, so we should treat everybody, number one, but number two, if we don't, then there's a potential risk that people like Kalakane could do something like he did. So it's not just about sort of being empathetic or showing care towards the individual. It's also about keeping our society safe if we don't.
That's a perfectly good answer, full of empathy, which is what I'd expect. And I completely agree with you as well. I was just wondering as well, given what you know about mental health now and you know, things like paranoid schizophrenia that can in rare circumstances lead to violent kind of attacks of this sort, has it changed your perspective on what would be legitimately termed good and evil? Do you find them terms even useful anymore?
So I mean, obviously I never use the terms good and evil clinically,
that would be odd.
But I do use the term psychopath. I don't think I can't use psychopath, by the way. Psychopathy, antisocial personality disorder, these are the kind of the equivalent terms, I suppose, of evil. So I think absolutely, I don't think this case has changed my view. I think I've always had the view that there are some people whose personalities are very aggressive, so completely unrelated to mental illness, who don't have paranoid delusions, but who are just aggressive, impulsive, lack empathy, don't care about the rights of other people, basically quite narcissistic, quite selfish, impulsive, lack fear, all of those things predispose individuals to violence. So I suppose that is the official sort of jargonistic psychiatric version of calling somebody evil, and I've always believed in that, and I've worked with people like that, and I continue to do so.
Okay, this might be too big of a question for the minute or so we've got left, but is it possible for someone like Kalakane, someone that far gone, to actually come back? Is that a thing that's ever happened in your experience? Someone, you know, struggling with mental health to a degree that they carry out a crime of this nature, and then can they come through this and understand what's happened to them?
Yes. So I've never personally rehabilitated somebody that's carried out three individual stabbings or three stabbings in one go, but I've assessed and helped or been part of the process of rehabilitating many, many people, probably, you know, over 10, 20, who have killed one individual in a florid psychosis like Kalakane, and who have got better. Now, another very controversial thing to say in the last minute is that people are talking about him as if he's never going to leave this high secure unit. And I think the judge even said that it's very likely that you'll spend the rest of your life in the high secure hospital. But with all due respect, it's not up to the judge. He doesn't have the power to say that. It's up to one person and one organization, the person being the forensic psychiatrist that treats him in Ashworth, the high secure hospital. And number two, the Ministry of Justice have to kind of okay any leave or discharge that he might have in the future. And I think politically, they might not ever let him leave, or might not let him leave for decades, because of how big and shocking and controversial and contentious this story has been. But clinically, it's more than possible that he could, the symptoms that he had could resolve because he wasn't taking his medication. If he was taking his medication, if he tried two or three different medications and he still had symptoms, which I've also seen in some patients, then I would say this is treatment resistant and he might not ever get better. But he wasn't taking his medication. So there's a fairly strong possibility that if he is taking medication, possibly in depot form, injectable form, like I suggested, he could actually get those symptoms that he had, the voices that he heard, the paranoia can disappear. That happens quite frequently with people with schizophrenia. So there seems to be this sort of false narrative that he's going to be in prison, in hospital for the rest of his life. But clinically, he might actually get better. And I'm not saying, again, I'm not talking about any sort of ethical consideration. I'm just saying that I've seen patients like him, lots of them who have got better.
That's a great answer. Excellent insight, as always, Shaman. It's great to see you as well. Maybe you can let people know where they can find more of your output.
Sure. It's always a pleasure to speak to you, Stephen. So I've got my YouTube channel, A Psych for Soul Minds, put up videos about once or twice a week. So recently I've done videos about stalking. So my sort of five tips of how to deal with a stalker. I've also done a reaction video to Joe Rogan, who spoke about why he thinks some women fall in love with serial killers. So I've kind of critiqued to that. So just a kind of mishmash of issues related to mental illness and offending.
Awesome. Thank you very much. Have a pleasant evening. Hopefully see you again soon.
Cheers, Stephen. Always a pleasure. Bye.
Bye.